Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 77. Today we discuss an article by J. Richard Hackman and Greg R. Oldham titled Development of the Job Diagnostic Survey, published in the Journal of Applied Psychology in 1975. This is part one of the episode, where we will discuss the author's presentation of the Job Diagnostic Survey, or JDS, and its contributions to the study of job design. To get the text and other associated readings, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hello, this is Pedro coming to you from Copenhagen in a beautiful spring day.
Hi, this is Greta coming from the Royal Borough of Windsor.
And hi, this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States, and it's actually snowing here today.
And this is Lisa calling from Montreal in Quebec, and our snow today is melting.
Welcome, everyone. Okay, so we have Lisa as a special guest here, Dr. Lisa Cohen from McGill University, the Deshotels Faculty of Management in Montreal. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Really thrilled to be here. I get to talk about jobs and job design. I don't get to do that often.
Yeah, exactly. And this is it is the topic of a conversation. We have chosen a very interesting article this month, The Development of the Job Diagnostic Survey. And this was jointly published by J. Richard Hackman and Greg R. Oldham. And this is back in 1975 in the Journal of Applied Psychology. And they had actually published a whole series, a whole slew of articles right around that same time, all about this job diagnostic survey instrument. The particular reading that we're looking at focuses on the conceptual basis of the instrument, and basically tries to offer its validation. But Lisa, you're very well versed, much more versed in this than I am. Please tell us about the article.
Okay. Yeah, so it is, as you said, it's building on a lot of work that was being done at the time, a lot of it about different aspects of motivation. Expectancy theory was a big part of it. Some work that Hackman and Oldham had done previously. The paper is really aimed at trying to help managers to increase the motivational potential of jobs. And usually when we're talking about that, we're talking about jobs that are relatively fixed. And they had two ideas. One, they wanted this to diagnose existing jobs, so look at what is there and understand how motivating it is, but also to suggest changes to jobs to improve their motivating potential. This has been sort of the core of a huge body of organizational behavior micro research. The essential idea is that this tool is used assign a motivating potential score to jobs. It's based on five attributes, and together these five attributes are going to do things like produce meaningful jobs, jobs where people have a sense of responsibility, and jobs where they have knowledge of the results of the job. So those five dimensions get meaningfulness from skill variety, from task identity, from doing significant tasks. The sense of responsibility comes to us through the amount of autonomy we have, and then the knowledge of these results comes from feedback. And it's not just about the job. There's an individual aspect of this, which is something called growth needs strength. So how much do you want to grow? How motivated do you want to be? That's going to moderate the effect of this. The idea essentially is higher JDS scores are going to lead to better performance, more satisfied employees, motivated employees, less absenteeism, less turnover. So all of these really, really nice, appealing things. And this was and is a really appealing thing. We all want to think about things like, how do we enrich jobs? And it goes hand in hand with this undying belief we have that happy workers are better workers. And I say undying because it's also pretty much a false belief. It's not, there's a lot of evidence that that is not the sequence, that sometimes it's happy employees are happy because they're performing well. And I think that the one of the key things here is this is a really appealing, simple model. And I look at a lot of the job design work that's done on the more micro side. I look at HR textbooks, and I think all of them at their core still have this model there. I think that's a problem because I don't think that model is quite right.
So maybe before we start unpacking, you know, the shortcomings and the connections that the model has led to, maybe we can situate it in the history of organizational research, right? Thinking about the podcast we did in the past. And here we are in the realm of a more psychological way of looking at work, of course, obviously. And we are in the realm of trying to understand the design of the job. Right? So there are echoes of people like Taylor, of course, and others. We are not in the realm of people from like the Tavistock Institute that have tried to look at the interaction, the group through which the work gets done, but more about how the job is designed at the level of the task. And as Lisa was saying, across these different dimensions, the variety of the task, the sense in which the worker feels that the finishedness that exists is clear, whether it depends on feedback, to the extent that the worker has the ownership, so to speak, of the task in itself, or if it depends on others, right? So that is the kind of reason that is going on here.
And you mentioned the historical perspective. I'd like to take us back even farther than Frederick Taylor. I was in Edinburgh back in the days when we could travel, home of Adam Smith, who famously talked about job design or about the division of labor. He talked about pin making and how you could take the tasks and divide them up into making the straight piece and making the head and putting them together. And somehow by doing that with many more pins in the same hour of time. I think also you are asking about the micro foundation here, but I'll pick up more on the magical foundation. Can look at Durkheim talking about the inevitability of the division of labor. We can look at Weber talking about the advantages of having clear and known division of labor. And then we can to people like Frederick Taylor and his time in motion studies, how dividing up the tasks really well will do a better job at motivating. I think his name was Smith. And even within the Hawthorne work, right? What I think is interesting about this work and about the Hackman and Oldham work, very much about a one best way. What is the best way to design job? What's going to get you the best performance?
Lisa, that's very interesting that you tell a bit about, you know, like the intellectual legacy of the authors and where their ideas come from and, you know, the different trends that were going on at the time. I would love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so we're talking 1975, the 1970s. Think about who was publishing related to this topic. Interesting, right? Henry Braverman was talking around this time, as was at the same time Oliver Williamson, both of them talking about and writing about the division of labor and how best to divide labor and how dividing labor in certain ways will give you desired outcomes, whether it's control of your workers or control of transaction level outcome. Also at the same time, I actually did a little search through ASQ and what was being written around 1975. We were still deep into talking about various forms of contingency theory, still very much dominant environment uncertainty, ban of control, centralization, starting to write about things like power and interorganizational dependence on Van Manen, writing about police work and occupations, roots of other work that ends up being very important for understanding of job design.
So I think that besides this kind of shared perspective, right, because we can see this attention to the dimensions of job, right, that's very reminiscent of contingent thinking. And we had that in previous episodes. We, you know, the idea that structure has many dimensions that came from the Aston School and so on. But I was thinking also there is a kind of an elective affinity with the particular type of organizations that were dominant, perhaps, or thought to be dominant, and the ones where all this theory was coming from. Because there's a very industrial type of setting in this idea. Even, you know, I look through some of the questions that were asked in the instrument that the workers would complete, and it's very much about this idea of this factory type of setting, right?
Yeah, I think going with that, it was really about big organizations, and it could be in an industrial setting. It didn't have to be industrial, but multiple people doing the same job, multiple people doing jobs that are relatively fixed. And this all came back to haunt them. Haunt is maybe an exaggeration, but years later, when the world very much stopped resembling what it was at that time.
Super interesting. And also that you brought up Braverman and Williamson. You know, Williamson has this very interesting 2x2 model in one of his papers in American Journal of Sociology to look at, you know, what type of employment relationship is right for the type of job that it is, and when should you hire a person in what type of contract should come with it. You know, what this paper does is, okay, looking at, okay, well, what then does that mean for the worker? And you kind of mentioned, you know, the way the fish is swimming, and you kind of made a critical note, but I think it's nice to dive a little bit into that. Like, you know, what were the ideas that went into this paper? I personally found this figure one, you know, it gives a nice overview of it, like looking at these core dimensions that you mentioned and, you know, these different psychological states, and then looking at, you know, what are then the personal work outcomes. The whole paper is basically about proving that this model is right. If I summarize it, you know, they did this study of how many companies was it? I think it was 63 or something, or it was 63 jobs. Basically, I wanted to know, like, the differences between the jobs, how people score differently between the jobs, but this is not where this paper is about.
Right.
Yeah, personally, I was thinking about, you know, our jobs as academics. You know, when I was reading this paper, I was really thinking, assessing, like, the quality of my own job and how I can make it, like, a better experience. You know, direct feedback with 3 months waiting times to get a rejection of a submitted paper. You know, that's clearly one that we can improve.
Yeah, our jobs are great. We have skill variety. We have research, teaching, service, although we don't always like that variety. We have task identity. We're doing work that really matters. We have a nice amount of autonomy, although we all complain about the times when we lose that little bit of autonomy. But yeah, that feedback piece is impossible. We don't get feedback for months. I didn't get my first job design paper published until about 15 years after I started working on it. So it's a huge part of the problem.
But maybe we can start exploring that, right? Because the assumption of the model is, as Greta was saying, there is this interesting figure that summarizes, right? On one side, on the right-hand side, it shows what is the outcomes that are desired, right? The performance, the motivation, the satisfaction, low absenteeism. So that is what, you know, we would expect to get. And then the person, you know, the authors go upstream, so to speak, and look at exactly these core dimensions that Lisa just, you know, listed, which are supposed to lead to that, you know, and they put as an intermediary between the two, these what they call the psychological states, right? Because these different dimensions are going to lead to more meaningful work, a sense of responsibility, and so on. But it doesn't work all the time, right? And the argument is very much that you can get to this general thing. But I'm going to play devil's advocate, because I wonder that what is missing in like academic work or other forms of knowledge work is the fact that it's not structured through clear tasks, right? In a way that, yes, the dimensions are present, but the structure of the work in itself, it's not linear, it's not supervised in a direct way. There is not a clear sense of what comes after the order and how the tasks are ordered, which I think already tried to allude a bit to some of the shortcomings of the model, right? And maybe I think Lisa has ideas on that.
Yeah, so there are a lot of things I question in this model, and I even want to talk about how Hacken and Oldham came back and questioned it themselves in 2010 when they published a volume on the future of job design research. A big question is, how does it apply to knowledge work, where you're right, you're missing the clear demarcation where work is often done at a group level as opposed to an individual level, so it can break down in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I was going to offer that, you know, I guess it depends on the degree to which you really have true knowledge work being done. Because when I think about administrative assistants, I think about teachers, not academic professors, but say elementary school or, you know, at the lower levels. There's a lot of positions of that nature where you can see an analog between the, say, how this model would apply to the dimensions would apply to an industrial setting versus, say, something else a little bit more, you know, softer or more knowledge-based. Even though there's, and it kind of gets to, like, how they define some of these terms, like skill variety and task identity, task significance, even a varied set of tasks can become boring after a while. Can't look at it as just a very, very simple dimension. It really does, I think, depend on, you know, what is perceived by the individual, which is what how it would be perceived, which is kind of what I get from that critical psychological state, especially the meaningfulness of the work, because a tremendous variety of tasks can become overwhelming, where, you know, it's like not more is better.
Yeah, and that's one of the lines of criticism, that sometimes this ends up being a model of job enlargement instead of job enrichment. It's also the case that, you know, we talk about variety and variety is being good, but what if the variety that includes a lot of things that you don't like, that are not interesting to you? So I have to grade papers, and I don't find that very interesting. To enter data and collect data, that's variety, but it's not enriching. I also always wondered with this model, there's this bizarre thing where the first three dimensions are additive and the second two are multiplicative. And I could never, ever for the life of me make sense of this. I don't know if anybody in the world has, but I certainly have not.
Well, I found it interesting that there was another paper that they published, I don't remember if it was 74 or 76, where they actually laid out all of the different formulas that they used and tried. And you know, so they tried additing them all, or just purely additive, and then they tried purely multiplicative, and they tried a bunch of different things, and decided that this was the best by treating the three factors that go into the meaningfulness of the work. That was skill variety, task identity, and task significance, and say, well, we'll take the average of the three, because perhaps maybe, you know, in the different designs, they weighted, they were sort of like together, but they were different according to different types of jobs. So it's like, all right, this was a way of trying to treat it as a single variable. But that was, that was kind of interesting to see them actually walk through and explain why they came up with this formula as opposed to other options.
That's really interesting. Thanks for finally explaining that to me, because I've wondered for a long time. I think that today we might call that data mining or p-hacking, just sort of shopping for the model that fits the data best. I guess that at that time, that was what you did when you were trying to validate a model.
Yeah. Now, Another thing, to go back to the context at the time, is it fair to say, though, that at the time, when we're looking at what this was trying to accomplish in terms of enhancing or enriching jobs, I mean, was it because it was perceived that in the industrial setting specifically, that things had gotten so rote that it was driving people crazy, and this was what this was the specific problem that they were trying to solve?
Yeah, I guess we are very critical of this, or I'm very critical of this in retrospect, but I think you're right that in the time, and think about the intent, and the intent really was, let's make people's jobs better for them and for the organization. And that is a good thing. In a way, if I think about this, this is a precursor to positive organizational science, because that is what they were trying to do.
Indeed. And I was going to, you know, I'm glad that Tom is bringing us back, because I think it's important to acknowledge, you know, what this effort, this intellectual effort means in the spirit of the time. And yes, we look back and we see there was this kind of managerialist idea that the job is top down, someone is designed a certain way, and so on and so forth, and blah, blah. But again, that was the spirit of the time, right? Large organizations that were extremely hierarchical, with the assumption that the job was going to be designed by someone at the top, and so on and so forth. And of course, we learned from Hawthorne that people have their own understandings about their tasks that they are doing. But this was speaking to that general zeitgeist, right, for a management audience. And there's also something beautiful about trying to achieve the parsimony of these contingent times, right? Because in a way, although the dimensions are very broad and, you know, can be put in different ways, as Lisa were saying, they are still, in a way, one shape or another, part of what we are talking about in organizational science. The idea of skill variety, well, it has been transubstantiated, perhaps, in the idea of job rotation, right? In some cases, that is still very applicable. The idea of task identity, again, from Tavistock onwards, the idea that you can, you know, your day can fit the end of a task is very important. Sometimes as an academic, I wish there was some of that, right? That you could feel that you conclude something after a normal stint of work. The idea of autonomy, I mean, how many papers are still discussing exactly the sense of responsibility, how it's connected to the work? Those dimensions have been seeds that have been expanding multiple ways according to all kinds of conversations, right?
I think there are reasons that we go back to this paper so often. I know that when I teach about job design or motivation in an organizational behavior class, I almost always have a version of that model that I show to people, because that is a really easy way to think about things, and it appeals to the students. I will always complicate that model and bring in other things, but that's so appealing. And I think there are also reasons why people like Morgeson and Humphrey and Sharon Parker still really go back to this work. I still see this as very much at the heart of what they do. They may say that it's not, but I have a hard time seeing that. I see it really very strongly there.
So perhaps I can highlight some things that I found interesting in some of the empirics that Hackman and Altman are presenting in this paper. And the first one is about table 2, which is on page 164. And basically what these researchers did was they didn't only ask workers to rate their jobs, they also asked their supervisors to do the same. And then they also had like a bunch of scientists to look at the jobs and try to objectively score those different qualities. And basically in this table, you see some interesting numbers that make you reflect on, okay, like who is in charge of evaluating a job? And some of the correlations between those ratings are even negative. For instance, you know, the amount of feedback that a worker gets from the job task itself or from their supervisor the correlation between the employee and the supervisor on the latter one is 0.07. So, you know, I assume that the workers say, like, I hardly get any feedback. And then the supervisor says, yes, I give feedback all the time. Another one is, you know, the employees and observers have a negative correlation there. I found that very interesting. So what does this mean? Really interesting to think about, like, how the way a job is being perceived, it can be complete misunderstandings between the superior and the subordinate. There was one of the things that I found really interesting.
Yeah, and that is reflected in the world we live in. I think managers rarely really understand what their workers are doing. Even if they were promoted up through the ranks, they forget what it was. I used to do some time and motion studies when I worked as a consultant, and I would interview supervisors about what it is that their managers, their employees did, and they would tell me things. They would never fold shirts. They would never fold shirts. And I would go into the store and follow the person and sit there while they folded shirts for an hour at a time. They just don't understand it. One of my favorite assignments for when I teach about human resources or talent management, which is do some shadowing or do a job analysis of a job they dream of having. Once people do that, I've seen many people kind of switch their idea of their career. They no longer want to be lawyers when they find out how it is often a really dull job.
Perhaps this links very nicely to this table three, actually. So table three kind of gives like the descriptives of the scores of these workers, the 658 employees on average on their job. And basically, you know, like the researchers had like a 7-point scale. One is like least applicable and the other, and seven is most applicable. And what you see here is that, you know, most of the scores are 4+. You know, some are in the fives, and they're a couple of high threes. But, you know, in general, people were quite content with their jobs in this sample. And then, like, there is a note further down on page 166 that mentions a different study. There were other scholars that used the same diagnostic for public employees. And they had like this Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And basically what they found is that the mean scores for these EEOC samples, they were actually higher than the sample of jobs in the business organizations that were included in this study. I found it really interesting. And I was wondering, like, you know, we have these current conversations that most jobs, I wonder like what the scores would be nowadays if we would do the same survey again.
Yeah, we see in a lot of surveys, like climate surveys, that these numbers actually just ratchet up and up and up. So I'm not sure that even though we are calling jobs crap jobs these days, I'm not sure that that is how people would report them. They might believe it, but I'm not sure what they would actually fill out when they filled out the survey. Do I believe people are, you know, who are saying they get no feedback from their supervisor are also relatively happy with their jobs? That's really inconsistent with the whole model.
That's a very good point you bring up there. And, you know, this was also something I was thinking about as I was reading the paper. Like, you know, these scholars had very good and positive intentions building this survey, but then I was wondering, how is it actually implemented in practice? Like, has it been taken up and for what purpose? Because if as an employee you get asked to fill in this survey, and then, you know, in your annual review they bring up, like, you know, you're very dissatisfied with my feedback, well, you can go somewhere else, find a different job. Do organizations actually want to improve the jobs that they offer, or are they only interested in finding the right person who doesn't complain?
I have a little bit of defense, and then again, I think I'll switch it around the role.
Yeah, I played the devil's advocate there.
Yeah, no, because at the end of the paper, they do talk about some of the conditions in which they think that this instrument can and should be used, right? And they talk about things like, you know, from the literacy of the workers because they are compiling and filling the forms, but also about anonymity, that in principle should only use that if there is anonymity. Exactly, that's the idea, right? And they're talking about trying to arrive at the average and trying to get, you know, truthful response. Or of course, that is the general methodological type of things you would expect. But I wanted to expand a little bit more what you said, Greta, about the misalignment between the responses of these different groups, right? Because in a way, I totally see what the authors are trying to do, right? They wanted to build the instrument and they expect the instrument to be used in other research. But I find that the real, one of the interesting kernels of true findings here is exactly that there is not an alignment. And there is a lot of research that shows, you know, from shop floors to complex science work in which people do not really understand what they're supposed to do. It's not only that the feedback's missing in quantity, but the quality is different, right? And this goes on not just for the task in itself, but can go on related to the employment regime they're in. I have a friend who did an ethnography in factories, right, today, and reports stuff that is from Marx, right? The extent that the worker has clear the way through which you are paid or not, and so on and so forth, right? So I think that is an interesting insight that is just buried in an effort to try to arrive at a very neat instrument and validate it, right? But in the process of doing that, I think there is some kind of hidden interesting insights there in the paper.
Yeah, I think there's a great argument in this paper and in this conversation that the work that we're doing, the ethnographic work on work, is actually critically important because you need to have that detailed, competitive look to truly understand what people think. I don't think you can fully get it through a survey, at least not to understand reactions and intentions and what you really need in order to understand them.
I may also add that some of these dimensions, like feedback, we hadn't actually talked about the feedback dimension of this and how it's defined. Knowledge of the actual results of the work activities, I have to assume, is something that is vastly different in the context of 1975 than it is today, where, you know, if you were in an industrial setting or even in those early days of administrative assistants, secretaries, what have you, just about everything that you did, you probably had more of a sense of what exactly was the result of the work. You knew it was a lot more tangible. And I think about what kind of work is done nowadays, especially in like what administrative assistants do, or say the receptionist or the workers at a dentist's office or a medical office filing insurance paperwork. There's a big black hole mystery as to whether or not something was accomplished, where you send the job off to the system, and then you don't ever know whether or not anything resulted from it until the client calls back and starts complaining. And I have to believe that that's, you know, the way in which we've systematized, I don't know if that's the right word, but the way that that kind of work has been, you know, the system is built around that kind of work, has made it really difficult to narrow it down to say, okay, this particular job, what is the impact of the feedback one receives, you know, the results of the work, when you really don't ever actually know what the results of the work are.
I think there are a lot of efforts, though, now to measure everything and to only react and respond to those things that are measured. So you look at a receptionist and you measure how happy your clients are. You look at a professor and you look at how happy their students are. That's not really measuring learning, but we use these proxies instead. I also think that's one of the big things that people are going to be trying to use AI, is to try and find ways to measure things. I'm not sure that it can work or that it will work, but I think that's something people really would love to be able to do.
Yes, definitely. And, you know, what it makes us reflect on, or at least what makes me think about, is, you know, the ideas that go into such solutions. One of the quotes of the introduction of this paper mentions like the inherent difficulty to measure what happens when jobs change, and you know, the difficulty of measuring what jobs are like. When you mentioned, Lisa, you know, this quantification of different aspects of a job or the different aspects of how well a job is performed, you know, this is all scientific management. Are we still stuck in that age nowadays? What is it that we need to look at to really understand a job? You know, here there's clearly this positivist psychological approach that's being taken by these authors, as I learned from you, has gotten quite dominant within organizational behavior research. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, Van Manen is cited in the paper, his study of police work, like the ethnographic approach to really, you know, do the job to understand what it's like is a completely different ontology, epistemology, or, you know, just approach to understanding the world of work.
So I'm going to take a step back to then come back to what we are now in the conversation. Because I went and I looked at, you know, some of the real forms that people had to fill out, right? It's available online in an expanded version of the paper. And from what I saw, the way the questions were framed about task variety and so on and so forth, they were mixing the context of work, the way in which your supervisor relates to you, and the very modular type structure of the job, as if they were, you know, they were conflated. For example, when they're talking about feedback, they talk as if it was about the nature of the task, not the extent in which a supervisor is likely or not to provide feedback. When they're talking about this thing that they call the understanding of how your particular task fits in a particular, you know, can you see whether it fits in a particular outcome? Well, there's a famous story of the person at NASA that says, well, I'm not just mopping the floor, I'm putting the man on the moon, right? So even if you are doing routine, mundane work, the way in which you are able to understand how it pieces, it's about a whole lot of other things, not just the nature of the task in itself, right? So I wanted to talk about that as an example of how difficult it is to measure these things because they are intermingled with others. And now in which these metrics have become even more important because they determine, as Lisa was saying, we are going to use satisfaction to understand a good job of a secretary or of an academic, then it becomes even more tricky.
And we build these more and more complex performance management systems that fail to actually do what we want them to do, which is help people to get better in their job. You also raised something really important, Pedro, and I'm going to go to the critiques of this at the time, because there were many people like Carlene Roberts, Ricky Griffiths, Art Brief, Jeff Pfeffer, Allison Davis Blake, many, many more. And there were kind of two major lines of critique here. One, I won't go into the methods and validity of it. We kind of hit on some of that. But the really big issue that a lot of these papers hit on was that this ignores the context, the social context. How satisfied you are in your job is going to depend on things like, do you have any other option? The social information processing perspective. So that social context is important. It ignores this idea about if you're changing jobs, why are you changing them? So depending on whether this change comes from the person in the job versus the manager, the top down, it may have a really different sort of effect on the people. And I said that they themselves revisit this paper in their 2020 volume on the future of job design. And the points they raised here were the phenomenon of the job, of jobs has changed dramatically. They're no longer fixed. They're no longer individual jobs. Things are often done in teams. And in fact, they acknowledge that any predictions they made about how things were going to change in the future were all wrong. They missed where we started much more of a bottom-up model and self-managing.
I was going to say that I'm getting reminded by the episode we did quite some time back with Tristan Bamforth and their study on coal getting. It's exactly what you're getting at. Because they're, you know, the job, when they switch from one method of coal mining to another, all of the jobs remained exactly the same. The task, you know, all of the elements that are in here, at least in terms of the skill variety, task identity, task significance, really didn't change from one form to the other. But when they rearranged the system of doing the work, they significantly changed the way that people interact with each other, and the social fabric fell apart. And that definitely fell totally outside of where this survey went. It certainly illustrates the power of the context in job design. So, and now one of the reasons why I wanted to bring that up was because that was, if my math is right, it was about 24 years before this paper was published. So that,
yeah, you know, I love that paper and cite it often, whether it's relevant or not. It's so important, right? That social context is really gonna shape how it is, who you're working with, how you're working with them. And to ignore that is really missing out on a huge part of what is important. All of this leads us to thinking about, okay, if we have these problems with this model, what should research on job design look like? I have a critique of this model that's a little bit different, that this approach doesn't really do anything to explain how jobs come to be, why they look like they do, other than saying managers pretty much come in and create jobs. They try to meet technical and administrative imperatives. They just expect that people will do them. And that isn't what happens. I do think one of the beauties in this paper is it does highlight how important the design of jobs can be.
Perhaps you can expand more on this alternative model, because I know you did some work on that, Lisa, in the second part. But I was thinking, what would be our, you know, general takeaway from this paper? And as I listen to you all, my feeling has been more and more that, you know, there are all kinds of flaws in the way that the research was conducted and expectations that are maybe above what the data is really showing. There is all kind of assumptions, right, that we do not agree majorly, because I think we all come from a more social perspective and one that is not so managerialist as the one here. But as Lisa was saying, I think it puts at the table a concern, and it identifies perhaps not dimensions that necessarily go together and deliver the expected outcome as the paper supposes, but they are topics, variables, they are elements, right, that can be analyzed and explored in different ways, right? Because I think, as we were saying, autonomy is something that is important. We don't necessarily agree that it is so linear and it builds up to the outcome expected in the paper. But the topics that it brings, it's the creation of some of the vocabulary that became part, I think, of the discussions that we are still having today on jobs, but also seeing broader ones from the way occupations work to organizational structure and many, many others. So I see the paper as this introduction or reinforcing of a particular vocabulary.
Yeah, and I see that vocabulary often in work today. And often people don't know where it goes back to. They'll talk about autonomy or feedback or task variety without even knowing that this is probably the place they should go back to. I want to comment too on some other things I really like about this. I think breaking jobs down into different components is really important. We can't just think of this generic big job. We need to think about how different aspects will affect different people and will affect them differently. And then the biggest piece here for me is this reminder that how you design jobs, how you put things together, matters, and matters enormously for the people in the job and organization that the job fit in. And I think when we go to the next part, I'll talk more about some even broader importance of job design.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Audner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Vili Leidon-Virta, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.